This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Over the past few months, we've been hearing about plans to make public colleges and universities in some states tuition-free. But that hasn't happened yet, and none of these plans include private schools.
So you're still looking at close to $100,000 for a four-year degree at a public university, which is a big chunk of change.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk about the new edition of the book, Paying for College Without Going Broke. We'll also talk to an Iraqi refugee who became a published poet a little over a year ago at age 14. And we'll spend an academic minute with the lasting effects of Jim Crow laws. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The average cost of just 1 year at a private college in the U.S. is well over $30,000, and it doesn't look like that number will be going down anytime soon. Kalman Cheney wants to help. The 2017 edition of his book, Paying for College Without Going Broke, has just been published. Cheney is the founder and president of Campus Consultants, an independent firm based in New York that has helped thousands of families get financial aid since 1984. I spoke to Cheney and asked how long he's been publishing this book.
Okay, this is the 25th annual edition that comes out. It's published by Penguin Random House in conjunction with the Princeton Review, the SAT prep company, and it's based on my decades of experience since 1984 counseling individual families through my firm Campus Consultants on how to maximize their eligibility for aid and minimize college costs.
Is this mainly for private schools or for public also?
It's for public universities as well as private colleges, although certainly the concerns paying for the private colleges, especially the selected private colleges where the costs are $65,000, $70,000 a year, the chances of qualifying for need-based aid are better doing that because the cost is subtracted what you can afford to pay to determine your need. But even for the public universities, the average public university tuition fees, room and board, is now about $20,000. Some states it's even, of course, more than the average. So that's, you're still looking at close to $100,000 for a four-year degree at a public university, which is a big chunk of change. And there are strategies you can use to minimize those costs as well.
Are there more choices now than there have been in the past?
Yes, there are various options available. There are various aid programs that are out there, both from the federal government, the state government, and the colleges. That's the need-based money. There's also the merit-based scholarships that are offered by the universities because the schools realize more and more that there's, first of all, more price resistance among the consumers, the educational consumers, the students and their parents. So there's more of a need there to assist families with paying for it because a lot of people are questioning the value of it. We would certainly say everyone should go to college, but what you study and what you get out of the experience is more important necessarily than the bumper sticker that you have on the back of the car when you graduate. And you need to realize now more and more the schools operate like businesses and not to think in like charities. And you need to realize that there's a spin to the information you're getting from the schools and not just assume they're educators and they're going to tell you what to do to your best advantage. You have to be assertive with this process.
When you go about starting choosing a school, how far up or down the list should their financial aid package be?
Well, that depends on one's individual circumstances. Of course, you know, if you have unlimited wealth, you know, you can pick where you want to go. But if you're more like the typical person who's looking for college, that's very important to look at that and to think about that in advance. The traditional advice would always be pick the best possible school and then figure out how to pay for it. But nowadays, the best possible school is more the one where you're going to come out with the least amount of debt. Because where you go to school, again, doesn't matter so much as what you study. And a good rule of thumb is that you should have no more debt aggregate over the educational period than your first year's salary, at least in terms of a bachelor's degree coming out with that. The debt should not be more than the first year's salary of the job that you're looking for. So for people going into, say, engineering or tech, where they're going to make more money, they could afford to have a bit more debt. If you're going into a less lucrative profession where there's more uncertainty about your income, say, for example, you're an actor or you're an artist, you need to be more careful with that because your income is less predictable and accumulating a large amount of debt, you could be burdening that for years and living in your parents' basement for a long time.
How much back and forth is there? Can you really negotiate with schools about their financial aid, or is it just a hard, fast number they give you?
No, it's somewhat subjective. You don't want to use the term negotiate. You don't want the schools thinking you view them as a used car salesman the same way as that. But it is possible to do that. Certainly with the private schools, there may be more latitude because the school's giving out their own money. They have more authority over that. But even with the state schools, you can do an appeal, especially if there's been a change in your circumstances. With the new changes in aid now, there's a two-year look-back period in the income. A lot could happen since the time you earn that income that affects your aid and the time you're actually going to college. So if there's been a reduction in income, a loss of benefits, unusual medical expenses have cropped up, or another family crisis has occurred that's having a stressor on your family budget, that's something that can be explained to the school. But the key to doing things with this whole process is knowing how to demonstrate the aid. It's like preparing a court case. If you're just going to fill out the forms, hope for the best, and assume everything's going to work out fine in the end, you're not going to do as well as somebody who's savvy about the process, who understands how the eligibility is determined, who's done their homework, and understands how to present their case to best advantage.
I imagine the answer to this next question is it's never too early, but how early should people start planning for this?
I like to say 9 months before the child's born. And that's some myth that people have, is that if I save money for college, that's going to really harm me in getting aid. That's not necessarily true, but you need to be careful when you're planning early on. And we have a whole chapter in the book, Long-Term Planning Strategies, in terms of where you place the funds. Because if you're eligible for, say, for need-based aid down the road, if you're not in the most lucrative profession career path, which is okay, but you need to understand if you're likely to qualify for need-based aid, there's some funding vehicles that are not good and should be avoided. For example, we say in the book, put not your trust in trusts. Of a grandparent may be well-intentioned, but doing something like that is a problem. Custodial accounts, uniform transfer to minors, those have a chilling impact on aid because student assets are assessed much more heavily than if the same money is in the parent's name and, say, a 529 owned by the parent for the benefit of the student, or parents just having the money in a regular college nest egg under their own Social Security number and account number.
I was going to say the 529s then would be a good way to go on that.
Right. Those can be a good way to go. 529 plans, that refers to the section of the IRS tax code, section 529, where states and some outside organizations are allowed to offer these tax advantage vehicles to pay for college. In some states, they offer the prepaid plans where you buy college credits at today's prices, and regardless of tuition inflation, you have those credits. There's also the more common savings plans where the funds are contributed federally with after-tax dollars, but they grow tax-deferred, and then if the funds are withdrawn for qualified higher education expenses, there's no tax on the money involved, and the buildup in value also is not considered income in the aid formula. So those could be a good option to get some tax breaks. Some states offer some tax breaks with that, but again, there's the tax-deferred buildup of the money, and it could possibly be all tax-free if it's used for qualified expenses.
What are some of the common mistakes that parents and students make when going for aid?
The common mistakes a lot of families make is that they assume, again, that the colleges are charities, that the school is going to show them, or that the high school is going to show them how to present their case to get the most money, and they fail to realize that the colleges are really rationing money, not so much awarding out the aid. So you need to plan ahead as early as the ninth grade, even to start thinking about how parts of your financial situation are going to fit into the aid formula. The other mistakes a lot of families make with the process is that they don't understand why the questions are being asked. The forms, unlike the tax returns, don't contain the formula. So you can't determine the bottom line. And that's why in the book we explain line by line how every question on the form influences one's eligibility for financial aid. Another mistake for families is to outsource the process to the student. That's a recipe for disaster. Unless the parents have language issues, say they're here and the English is not their first language and the student knows it better, that is not a good idea to have the student totally in charge of the process. They've got enough to do with their admissions application, worrying about their studies in school, and if the student makes a mistake, the parents are going to be the ones who are going to be paying for that because of the opportunity cost of the lost aid. And if you do need some help available with the process, you don't need to throw up your hands in disgust. There are, you know, private consultants that can assist you with the process to navigate it for you to best advantage. There are fees involved, but I know from my own clients, especially with the private colleges, most of my clients save several times my fee in terms of the additional aid I'm able to give them just because the people don't know how to navigate this complicated process to best advantage.
So this is really a family affair then?
Yes.
Again, the name of Kalman Chaney's book is Paying for College Without Going Broke. It's published by Penguin Random House, Princeton Review Books. Still to come, a young Iraqi refugee talks about life in the U.S. and becoming a published poet. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Hanin Amari came to the United States with her family after fleeing Iraq through Syria when she was just 11. In 2015, at the age of 14, Hanin published a beautiful and moving poem called To the Sun. The poem is the story of Yasmin, a 15-year-old girl who recalls what life was like before her family was forced to leave their homeland and come to the United States. In it, Hanin describes the fear and uncertainty that her own family endured before coming to the U.S. Jordan Unverzad, a producer with Generation Justice, spoke to Hanin about her life and her work.
I'm Hanin, and I am 14 years old, and I've been living in the U.S. for about 70 years now, and I really, really love it. I've met some amazing people here, and I love to write, I love to read. I kind of like art in general and language art. And in Arabic, I would say, اسمي حنين واني عمري 14 سنة واني أحب أقرأ كل شيء هواية وأحب أكتب وأحب أرسم وصلي بأمريكا 7 سنين.
Tell me more about your writing. Was this the first poem you've written?
Actually, no. I've been writing for as long as I can remember, learning how to write and read. And this was actually one of my latest poems that I've written. But I've been writing, I think I kept a diary when we first got here. I used to write in Arabic, except now my writing has transitioned into English just because I'm more open to it, I guess. It's on TV, radio, music, books are in English, so I started thinking in English and writing in English more. And I just really enjoy to write.
Awesome. I used to write poems when I was your age as well, and I continue to journal, and it's a good way to kind of challenge ideas or find out things about yourself or just kind of release feelings.
Yeah. I use it a lot just to get to know myself. Sometimes when ideas don't make sense to me, I write them down. That way I can just look at it from a different perspective, if that makes any sense.
Totally. I agree 100%. What was it like getting such amazing feedback for your poem?
I can't even explain it. It just kind of felt like, wow, people listened and they liked it. And that kind of gave me a feeling of empowerment that I can get to people, that I can use my voice for more than just inspiration. If one, to make people feel like they're understood, their situations are not, they're not alone in what's going on with them. And that's kind of what I want to give them the feeling of, that I'm a person here and I'm a refugee and I've had the same experiences they've had. Also to inspire people to start writing because it's a way to connect with others. So I've met a lot of people and had different experiences just through my poem and getting it published. It's been really amazing.
Yeah, your voice is incredibly powerful and you have such a beautiful way of observing and describing things. I really liked the line in your poem, people here dress their dogs. I think it's funny, but it also really speaks to the ridiculousness of American consumerism. How have you started to form your identity in America?
Well, I think a lot of that has to do with my friends. And I've been trying to make myself based on things that they teach me and they show me, but then also mixing it with my original culture from Iraq. It's an interesting mix. Like, sometimes people, they won't notice that I'm not from here. And then I'll do something and they're like, wait, what are you doing? And I would just explain that this is how we do it in Iraq, or like different foods that I'll eat they've never even heard of. So I've been kind of building myself based on things that I like, that I see Americans do, and what I've already have. It's an interesting mixture.
What challenges have you faced and continue to face as you adjust to American life?
American life in general, sometimes the way they say things, or the way they joke, the way they act with each other. Even now with my friends, sometimes they'll talk a certain way or they say something and I take it too seriously, or I'd look at it a completely different way from what they meant. Also fitting in, just because, not trying to mold myself like them, but being able to understand them and them being able to understand me. It's been a challenge just to kind of try and understand what they mean sometimes. Or there are lots of things that I don't know about the American culture. Like, a bunch of people have seen Indiana Jones and I've never even seen that. Or they'll be talking about like Star Wars. I don't know what that is, and they're always surprised to that. Sometimes I'm new to things, and I still am. That's been the hardest so far, and it still is.
I haven't seen Star Wars either, and I still get made fun of for it, so don't worry.
That makes me feel better.
What do you miss most about Baghdad?
I would say everything, I guess, except all the heat and being really restricted, I guess. But I still feel like I had an amazing childhood. I remember going a lot to my grandparents' house, and the houses there, that's my favorite memory, remembering what the houses used to be like and different smells. I know that's weird, but sometimes I'll smell something here and it's really familiar, and that kind of takes me back to like my grandparents' house or our old house and our backyard. And at my grandparents' house, I used to stay a lot with my aunt, who was like my best friend, second to mom, of course. I remember she had her bed right next to a window, and the window was really big and she had plants around it. And I used to sit on the bed and just look out the window and kind of make up stories about the people that I see. I remember going around the house and just looking and exploring at things, and I used to think it was really, really big. And I just wish I could see everything one more time now to see if everything really was the way I thought it was before.
Do you plan on going back?
I don't think so. Right now, not in these conditions. Even if I go, I don't think I'll be able to see the house, because I don't know if it's the same anymore. So I would hope to, but I don't think it's possible.
Yeah. Is there anything you want Americans who may have never traveled to the Middle East to know about Iraq?
Everything is different. And people here, yeah, they wear clothes, and then people in Iraq wear clothes too. It's just completely different, different styles, different music, and a different way of just interacting with each other. And I'll say that most Iraqis that I've met have really bad temper, so be careful with what you say and what you mean. But then we'll also joke around, and we're really social people. We like to have family around all the time, and we're just really close in that sense. So yeah, and it's an amazing country, or at least I know it used to be. It blew my mind sometimes when I would see an old picture of what Iraq looks like, just because I don't remember anything about the outside except the houses that I used to live in. And sometimes the way people dressed, even it seems strange to me now, just because I don't remember it as much. So yeah, just keep in mind that everything is different.
Do you still write?
Yeah, I don't keep a diary, but I'll write poems, or sometimes if I see a movie, it gives me an idea. And then I'll be listening to music, and that kind of gives me an idea, too. So I'll build something up. It's like that. Sometimes I'll write about something that frustrates me. Or if I read a book and it really interests me, I'll take the way that I understand it and make a thought out of that and write it down. Or like I said before, I'll write down an idea to understand it better. And sometimes I'll just write down like parts of my life so that I can look back and see what it was before, because I'm always interested in what my mom's life used to be like, and I want to make sure that I know that I have a way to remember what my life used to be like maybe 20 years from now.
When I was mad at my parents, I'd write down like parenting tips to my future self. Don't do this. Don't do that. What sort of role does music play in your life? I know you play the viola.
Music not only inspires me, but I love to make music just because it gives me a completely different feeling from writing or listening to music. And I just feel like everything is better with music. It just gives me a whole new spirit. Sometimes even taking a test and listening to music, I can do that. Going bowling, listening to music, it just kind of pumps me up. I love it so much. And playing the viola has just made me more experienced with that. I got to know it from a different angle. And usually I'll tell my mom at concerts that you get to listen to it from the outside, but I'm inside the music. I am making the music. And it just, it's completely different when you're making it versus when you're listening to it. I think it's amazing to be able to do that.
Is there anything else you want to add?
You'd be surprised at things that you're able to accomplish if you try. And I know you've probably heard that a lot, but I never thought to try and write a book and get it published, but I have thought about writing. And so if you're really into something, then try to make something out of that, especially if you're good. Then there's always a chance that you'll be able to make it more than it is. If you like writing music, then start composing and then show somebody, and then it can be something amazing. So yeah, have courage.
I just think you're such an amazing human being and so talented, and I'm happy that you're continuing to write, and I hope that you continue to share what you write. I look forward to reading future poems, and I feel really privileged to be able to speak with you today and hear you recite your own poem. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much. Just hearing that makes me feel amazing, too.
That's 15-year-old poet Haneen Amari speaking with Generation Justice producer Jordan Unverzat. Jim Crow laws have been off the books in most of the country for decades, but the effects of those laws still linger. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
The lasting impacts of Jim Crow can't always be seen with our eyes. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities, and today on the Academic Minute, Ruth Thompson Miller, assistant professor of sociology at the University of Dayton, discusses how some scars are carried on the inside.
I've studied the effects of the Jim Crow segregation laws when the law of the land required separate facilities for African Americans and whites. When we talk about those days, we often talk about drinking fountains, restrooms, buses, and schools, but it was much more than that. The law also condoned white violence against African Americans. I've talked with many elderly African Americans who lived during that time. Most knew someone who was raped, had land stolen, or who was injured or killed. As with many forms of violence, once the violence ends, the stress and negative psychological impact can continue. Imagine living every day of your life with the fear of death. The research on the long-term impact is compelling. The cumulative experiences of traumatic racial events have caused long-lasting psychological consequences for African Americans, which we call segregation stress syndrome. The symptoms include a loss of trust, feelings of fear and nervousness around the group that caused the trauma. People who suffer often avoid triggers, the places and things that are reminders of the traumatic event. The children and grandchildren of survivors may also suffer. It's passed down socially and biologically by the way we parent, the role models we have, the stories we tell, and our unconscious displayed emotions. Segregation stress syndrome can't be cured, only treated. Jim Crow laws were struck down many years ago, but we still see the effects today.
That was Ruth Thompson Miller of the University of Dayton. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.